welcome to Pod's Kiwiwi. I'm Josh Smith.
I'm Mike Graham.
Oh, Mike. So we took a little hit in week two of the CFL Podcast Family Fantasy League, but my, oh my, did we come back big time in week three. We were playing Joe Pritchard, USFL Tecmo, of the Rouge, White, and Blue podcast. We laid a beating on him, buddy. 244 to 153. We are now 2-1 on the season. Man, it was quite the beatdown. It was quite the beatdown.
That is quite the beatdown. Pretty good record at 2-1. I noticed that you're not doing so hot in our league, but neither am I.
Not at all. Last year I was a runaway juggernaut. This year I am very much on the precipice of the bottom of the league. I might even be in last place. It's still early. Not been good over there.
Still early. I think we're both 1-2, so we'll see what happens going forward. But good to get a win in the podcast fantasy league.
Yeah, it was. We had a Darius Bowman, and you were at the Edmonton game, correct?
Yes, I was.
Yeah, so you saw him go off for 140 yards and 3 touchdowns, and I'm watching the game going, thank you, Mr. Bowman, thank you, Mr. Bowman, and then it was a bit tight going into, because that was the last game of the week, if I'm not mistaken, and it was a bit tight going into that game, and then Bowman just goes off, and we win by almost 100 points. So our next game this week, we take on the BC Lions Den podcast. I've been a guest on that show. That's obviously a Lions-centric podcast that's hosted by Brian Warishin and Mojo Kemp. They are unfortunately 0-3 at this time, so this could be they either they're due for a win here, or we can bump this record up to 3-1. Things are looking good right now. I think I like where our team is headed in this league, and I think we're going to be battling it out to the bitter end to become the inaugural champions of this league.
Got to get that championship.
But I don't know if you've seen, because I, as we record this, you've just gotten home from work and all that stuff. I just found out through Twitter that apparently the BC, and I got to get this off my chest, the BC Lions have apparently told the guys at the Lions that they're not going to be supporting their podcast. They're not going to be allowing them to interview coaches or to interview players. And you and I don't actually go out there and try to get player interviews, so I haven't dealt with this any. I think we could if we wanted to, but it's just, you know, we've had a couple guests and all that stuff, but we kind of like to keep it just between you and I. But to hear this, I'm very disappointed. I think that this league, the CFL, needs to support things like podcasts simply because this is the way, I won't even say of the future, this is the way of the present. Like, they'll give access to media members who write for papers or do sports talk radio, and that's not something that people spend a lot of time on. Like, do you pick up the weekly paper? Do you listen to the local sports radio stations in Edmonton? I know I don't do it here in Hamilton. I get all my CFL stuff through podcasts and through like Three Down Nation and stuff like that. Young people, this league wants to attract young people, and if you're going to go after that demographic, you can't stick with the old traditional media. You have to go after blogs and podcasts and give those people access. To hear this, especially from a team like BC that is desperately needing fan attention, I'm very disappointed, and I think that team should be ashamed of what they're doing with Brian and Mojo.
Yeah, I don't really get that. I mean, they're trying to support the team. I know I think pretty sure they're both season ticket holders. So to turn down loyal fans that have pretty good following of their podcast is, you know, it's disrespectful. It's not cool. And CFL teams have kind of, well, here in Edmonton, I know that the Eskimos don't have a very good relationship with the media around here. They don't really like to give out interviews with coaches and all that kind of stuff. So I don't know what's going on with some of these CFL teams, but the more exposure, the better. So it's just a head scratcher in my opinion.
Yeah, you got these are two guys, like you said, season ticket holders. They're fans of the team. They have pumped in hours and hours and hours of effort into providing free publicity for this team and for the league as a whole. And for them to be treated this way is, it's shameful. It's absolutely shameful. And I stand beside our podcast brothers here, and I hope things get worked out and the Lions reverse their idea. You know what? If you're listening to this show, hit up social media, tag the BC Lions in your tweets and tell them what you think about this, because I think it's ridiculous. And I think maybe the more that they hear from people through email, through social media, through all these other sorts of avenues, the more they hear from people about how they think that this is absolutely ridiculous, maybe they'll reverse course and give these guys what they're looking for. But I stand with them, and I hope that they keep the show going, and I hope that things get worked out, because I just think this is ridiculous.
Yeah, they could sour on the team, you know. Like, I don't understand it either. It just seems silly to me.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. So we're with you guys, Brian, Mojo. Keep the fight. Go and do what you got to do, and hopefully this gets fixed in the near future. Game review time. I gotta admit, I did not think that we would be sitting here today talking about a loss. I was dumbfounded that the Hamilton Tiger Cats lost to the Winnipeg Blue Bombers at home 28-24 last Thursday. Mistakes, man. So that's basically the thesis of the game. It was turnovers. You cannot turn the ball over as often as the Tiger Cats did and hope to win. Simple as that.
Yeah, exactly. I don't have the numbers right in front of me right now, but I think it was four or five turnovers to one for Winnipeg. So, I mean, and they almost won that game. I mean, they could have won that game. It's just a very disappointing performance. I mean, we were talking about it last week. How are we going to feel if they lost to the Bombers? And I said I might hit the panic button, and I'm not there yet, but it's very discouraging to see all these mistakes, just the lost chances by the Ticats to win the game. They just didn't pull it out, and they didn't deserve to pull it out. Just like last week, they had a pretty, not as bad as last week, but they had a pretty poor performance again.
Yeah, I was saying that I was going to be freaking out if they would have lost this game, but seeing how it played out, I'm not as upset as I thought I would be going into the game, thinking if they lose this game, I'm going to be out of my mind. It was just, they kept shooting themselves in the foot, and we have to start with the man who shot himself in the foot the most, and that was Jeremiah Mazzoli. It feels like since week one, he has regressed. He took care of the football against Toronto and looked magnificent. And in these last 2 weeks, he's just looked like he's taken a step back. His stats were pretty good. If you look at the numbers, he was 29 of 39 for 367 yards and two touchdowns. So I know numbers can be deceiving, and these very much are, but then you got to add in, he had three fumbles and two interceptions, and it was at the times so many near red zone turnovers, so many, like the very last series, like you're watching him drive down the field and you're thinking, holy smokes, they might actually win this game. And then what do? He fumbles the ball, game over. And it was very discouraging to see someone who it looked like had taken the leap kind of take a couple steps backwards, and now it's less of a sure thing that he's the guy that can keep this team afloat until we finally get Zach back. I'm starting to worry. Look at the schedule now. They're on the road for four straight weeks. Could this team be 1-4 by the bye week? Like that's completely possible, and that's basically the worst case scenario for this squad is to only win one game while Claros misses time.
Yeah, it's like we win the first game of the season finally, and then we might go on a long streak of losing. So it could be all for naught, you know, that first win of the season. But Mazzoli, he moved the ball pretty well. He had some good drives going. Like you said, the numbers were, you know, pretty good, 29 39, 367 yards. I mean, that's a lot of yards to throw for. But like we're going to talk about a lot, it was just the turnovers. I mean, they'd have a long drive, and then he'd shoot himself in the foot. So, you know, I think Mazzoli is still a guy going forward until Claros comes back. I think he gives us the best chance to win, but he just has to eliminate the turnovers. It's just killing us. The fumbles on I think it was a 1 yard sneak. He had a fumble. That's just inexcusable. The last fumble of the game, he should have thrown it away. I mean, he saw the guy coming. Diakowski, you know, he has to take a little bit of the blame because he just got ran over. Just the defender went right by him, right to Mazzoli. So he has to take a little bit of the blame, but he could have got rid of that ball. And he just needs to be smarter, make smarter decisions, and not turn over the ball. And then we should win some games. But if he continues this way, I mean, like you said, we're going to be 1-4, 1-5 before Claros comes back.
Yeah, it would be very disturbing. And with a quarterback who is struggling in these aspects, why, and I'm going to harp on this probably until I'm blue in the face, but why does this team not use CJ Gable more? I just do not understand why he's not being featured in the offense more prominently. This was the second consecutive game that saw him get single-digit touches. He had 11 versus Toronto in week one, and then he had 9 against BC, and he only had 8 in this game. He might be, very well, the best all-around running back in the game. We know what he can do in pass protection. We know what he can do running the football. We know what he can do catching the football. And he's being used like some rando that they picked up off the street. Like, I said this on Twitter while I was watching the Eskimos game. I said, look at how the Eskimos use John White. That is how the Ticats should use CJ Gable. So I did a little number crunching and I looked up the stats. Now, John White has only played 2 games because the Eskimos have already had a bye. He has 25 carries for 138 yards and 2 rushing touchdowns, and he's also contributed in the passing game with 9 catches for 62 yards and a touchdown. Remember, that's in 2 games. CJ Gable has played 3 games, and he only has 25 carries for 126 yards and 3 catches for 15 yards, no touchdowns. He has not found the end zone. So John White, in one fewer game, has more carries, more yards, more catches, more receiving yards, and more touchdowns than CJ Gable. We all know what CJ Gable could do. Use him. Give him the ball. I'm not saying he has to get the ball 20 times a game, but 8, 9, 11, that's absolutely ridiculous.
Yeah, it's like they run the ball a couple times, and then Austin says, oh, this isn't working, so let's just abandon it. You know, you watched the game last week against the Bombers, and Andrew Harris, he got the ball quite a few times, I think. Well, 13 times, but you wear down a defense, and then they open up holes eventually, and later on in the game, they break some runs off. So that's what they need to do with Gable. They need to give him a ball in double digits and, give him a chance to do his thing. If it doesn't work out in the first couple handoffs, don't give up on it. Go back to it. And we know he has the talent, so he should be getting the ball a lot more than he has, even catching the ball out of the backfield. I mean, this guy, we all know how high we are on him, but he's just not getting enough touches.
Yeah, so it wasn't all doom and gloom here. There was some things out of this game that I liked, and the big one to me is what I have dubbed Hamilton's Big Three. I'm not talking about LeBron, Chris Bosh, and Dwayne Wade, or Kevin Garnett, Ray Allen, and Paul Pierce. I'm talking about Hamilton's Big Three of Luke Tasker, Andy Fantuz, and Chad Owens. Yes, Tasker had the fumble early, and that sucked. But after that, these guys were phenomenal. These are the numbers. Tasker, 8 catches for 91 yards. Fantuz, 7 catches for 89 yards and a touchdown. And Chad Owens, 5 catches for 92 yards and a touchdown. These guys have become so reliable, so deadly. If these guys continue to put up numbers like this when Caleros comes back, if they can do this with Mazzoli, look what they can do with Caleros. This is awesome to see these three guys contribute like this each week, putting up steadier and steadier numbers. These guys have been awesome, and I'm very happy with it. Chad Owens, we talked about this before the show. You mentioned it. I'm going to steal it from you. That might be one of the best free agent signings this team has ever made. He has been phenomenal.
Yeah, he's been great, very consistent. He's had really good numbers each game that he's played. So he's making plays out there. And, another guy it's great to see him producing is Andy Fantuz. I mean, 7 catches for 89 yards. And the first two games, he had phenomenal numbers as well. So we've said it before, if this guy stays healthy, he's still one of the best receivers in the league, especially Canadian receivers. He's just so valuable out there for those short passes to get those tough yards on second and medium, second and 10, second and long. So to see these guys do their thing with the backup quarterback is very impressive. And you can't say enough about Tasker. He's just Mr. Dependable. He catches everything that's thrown his way, and he puts up big numbers. So all three of those guys are phenomenal, and I just hope they stay healthy because I want to see them play all season long.
Fantuz is third in the league in receiving yards. Tasker is fifth, and Owens is eighth. Can't ask for much more. I know we've seen teams put 4 guys with 1,000 yards, but if all these guys play 16 to 18 games, Ticats are going to have 3 well over 1,000-yard receivers. Like I said, they're doing this with Mazzoli. Imagine what they're going to do with Caleros, who is the best quarterback in the CFL and can sling it like no one else. I'm very, very happy with the early returns from these guys and the fact that they're all healthy. And Tasker dealt with injuries last year at the start of the season and then came on and was amazing the rest of the way. Fantuz, we know his story. His entire playing history is injuries, unfortunately. And even Owens the last few years has dealt with his fair share of injuries. So see all these guys contributing week in, week out, putting up these steady numbers. It's awesome to see. And if we got to take, we can't just always be negative when the team loses. We have to look at some positives. This, to me, is one of the big positives. These guys are continuing to do everything right week in, week out. Awesome stuff. Let's go to the defense. What do you got defensively, Mike?
Well, once again, not overly impressed with the defense. I'm looking at the leading tacklers in this game, and it's Emmanuel Davis, it's Courtney Steven, it's secondary guys that are getting the most tackles, and that tells me that they're completing a lot of passes downfield, and the secondary making most of the tackles. So I don't know, their run defense was okay. Andrew Harris had 63 yards on 13 carries, which isn't phenomenal, but he had a couple of big runs that really hurt the team. His longest run was 18 yards, and that was a tough one to take. So, I'm not overly impressed with this defense so far this year. They did well in Toronto. They did okay in the first half of the last game, and then kind of fell off with the penalties and all that. But yeah, just not overall impressed with what's going on that defense.
Yeah, it looks to me like it's going to take a little while for these guys to click. We have to remember they lost a lot of guys on their, like, they decided to let these guys go. Don't get me wrong, they did not bring back Brian Hall, Justin Hickman. The list goes on and on and on of the guys that they let walk in the offseason. So I think it is going to take a little time for this defense to gel. I too have not been overly impressed with how they've played outside of the first game in Toronto and that first half of BC. We're definitely on the same page here. I do still think that this is a team that has a lot of talent on the defensive side of the football. They have maybe the best defensive player, period, in Simone Lawrence. The defensive line, I thought, played decently. Drake Nevis really came on, I thought, in this game. Finally, look, he's played well these first two games, and this was kind of maybe his coming out party. He had the big sack on Drew Willey. He was disruptive all night. It wasn't a perfect defensive performance by any means, but I also think that their performance was hindered a bit by all the turnovers. You can only have the defense on the field so long before they get tired, and I think that was a product. Maybe their lesser play in this game was more of a product of just being on the field too damn long.
Yeah, that could be. The defense got to get tired after being on the field. I mean, the time of possession was 33 minutes to 26 minutes for the Bombers, so they were on the field for quite a long time, so it's tough. They only had two sacks this game, which isn't terrible, but Winnipeg had four. So, you know, we talked about it in the game preview last week. It's the offensive line of the Bombers has had a tough time this season, last season, the season before. So to only get two sacks is kind of disappointing. But I do like Drake Nevis. I think he's a beast in the middle. I think he's a real keeper. And have him and Laurent in the middle of that defensive line is quite scary.
So there was something about the defense that I noticed that I wanted to get your opinion on and see if you noticed it as well. They were really bad on second down, and they were especially bad on second and long. There was one play in particular that stood out to my mind late in the game. They had, I think it was second and 21, and they allowed Willie to hit Darvin Adams for a 40-yard pass. Now, Winnipeg ended up fumbling later in that drive, but it's like you get a team at second and 21 and you give up a first down, that's not good.
You might as well just give up and let them have the first down because they're going to let that play happen. I mean, it just seems like over the years it's just happened over and over and over again in big situations like the Ottawa game last year in the playoffs, like the Saskatchewan Grey Cup game where
the Corey Sheets
run.
Yeah.
So it's starting to become kind of a ritual for this team. I don't know what's the deal with that. I don't know if they're dropping off too much with Steinhauer's defense or what's going on, but second and 20 plus, there's no excuse for that team getting a first down. I mean, it's just ridiculous.
No, like Ed Gainey was to blame for the Ellingson catch last year, but he was out in Edmonton playing with the Riders last week, doing his patented fall down as a pass goes over his head for a touchdown. He's not there to blame this on anymore. Yeah, I was just really disappointed in how I saw them play on second down. It was very disheartening because you're thinking, okay, they got him in second and eight, like they can get a stop here, and they would give up 12 yards. And oh man, like it just seemed constantly that the defense would make an excellent play on first down. Either the Bombers would run and only get a couple yards or whatever they did, and then second down would come with a chance to get them off the field and maybe flip momentum, and it just never came. And I think, again, that's part of the reason why this defense struggled. They couldn't get off the field on second down. They're on the field longer, and Winnipeg, you know, did what they had to do to come out of this game with a victory. It was just very disheartening to see them give up so much in second down.
Yeah, for sure. And there was a special teams play early on in the game. I think it was Courtney Steven who stripped the ball out and then tackled him by the legs, the player by the legs, and Hamilton recovered the ball. I thought that was a beautiful play by him, a really smart play, and I just want to commend him for it.
Yeah, you know what? You brought up special teams. Let's get into some special team stuff here. And basically what I have dubbed the good and bad of Speedy B. Obviously, we're going to gush over the 120-yard missed field goal return that was just awesome. If you watched it live or even on replay and you saw him, he fakes right and then darts left, and it's like he's gone from then on. Like he had to break like maybe one tackle, and then there's a convoy taking him to the end zone. Got the team going. That was early in the game. You're thinking, oh man, okay, they're back. They score on special teams. That's what they do. They're going to get defensive touchdown. Like you think, oh wait, they're looking like that team that we saw most of last season. And then of course he has the complete brain fart on the kickoff just maybe a quarter and a half later, where he lets it bounce and it rolls backwards and Macho Harris picks it up and Winnipeg ends up scoring a touchdown on that drive. It's just, I don't want to knock him too much because everyone has those moments where it's like, what was I thinking? But you got to take the good with the bad. Like, if we're going to give up something like that, I guess you got to take it, because he could do things like return a missed field goal 120 yards for a touchdown.
Yeah, and then you look at his punt return numbers. Now, he only had one return, but it was minus 8 yards. That's when he went backwards quite a ways. And, you know, it's Speedy B. I like him to do what he has to do to get return yards. But, you know, sometimes it's just better to maybe just fall down and not lose any yards instead of running back 10 yards and tackled deep in the Ticats' end.
Yeah, he sometimes has a bit too much confidence in his own speed, and you can kind of understand why, because we've seen over the last three seasons what he can do. But at the same time, it's like you see things like that, and it's like, you know what, sometimes a five-yard gain is all right. You got to get that, get the offense on the field, and yeah, it can be frustrating sometimes. Another thing special teams-wise that stood out to me was Brett Maher's punts. Now, he's a fairly decent punter, but I don't think he had a great game punting the football. His hang time seemed very, very low, and I think that really helped Winnipeg establish some better field position, because even if you boom at 60 yards, if it's only up there for 3.5-4 seconds, your guys don't have a chance to get down there. And I think that set up a lot of space for Quincy McDuffie to make some moves and set up Winnipeg in some really good field position. We talked about the coverage units last week against BC and how they weren't very good. And I think this week they didn't look good because I didn't think Maher's punts were that good.
No, he only had a 29-yard average on the night. So that's, his longest was 50 yards. So he did have, you know, at least one good punt, but that's not a very good average. So, yeah, punting seems to be one of his strong suits. So hopefully he has a bounce back game. He made all his field goals, which was just one, but it was from 48 yards. So that was good to see, a long field goal at Tim Hortons Field for him. So hopefully his punting's better and he can keep hitting those field goals from long distance.
So there's something I want to bounce off you, and I've been thinking about this since the game happened, and I was like, I really want to talk to Mike about this. There were some coaching decisions in this game that left me scratching my head, three in particular. So the first one, and I want to see how you feel on this, the Ticats score on the Chad Owens touchdown, and they're now down 25-23. It's late, maybe midway through the third quarter. It's in the third quarter. We haven't got to the fourth quarter yet. Why didn't they go for two? If they go for two and miss it, regardless of what Winnipeg does, like Winnipeg would go and kick a field goal, so they'd be down by five. Hamilton's still in the same situation at the end of the game, needing a touchdown to win. But if they would have made it, it would have been 28-25. Maybe Mazzoli's not making those bonehead fumble plays, and the Ticats are kicking a field. They clearly got deep enough. I think they were at like the 14-yard line on the last play of the game. So they were clearly deep enough to where they could take in a shot at the end zone and then set up a field goal to send this thing to overtime. Were you surprised that they didn't go for two? Or if you were in that situation, would you have gone for two? Because I know I would have.
Yeah, I was a bit surprised, especially with the league moving up the ball to the 2-yard line, I believe, on 2-point conversions last season. So, you know, that's pretty good odds. You're going to punch that in for the 2 points. So, and they move the single point back, the extra point. So I would have went for the two and make it a 3-point game. I don't think you have anything to lose in that point of the game, the way that it was going. So yeah, I think it was a questionable decision, and I would have went for it for two.
Okay, good. I'm glad we're on the same page there. You got Luke Tasker, who's got, you know, hands like glue. You got Andy Fantuz, who's got hands like glue. You got CJ Gable coming out of the backfield if you want to. There's so many options for this team in a 2-point setting that it really boggled my mind why they wouldn't go for two to tie the game up at that point. And then again, like I said, it sets them up. They're in no worse position whether they make it or miss it. So yeah, it was. I'm glad that we kind of agree on that. Another one that came up for me was after three Justin Medlock field goals, the Ticats opted to take the kickoff as opposed to taking the ball at the 35-yard line. They only got the ball off those three kickoffs, just one got to at least the 35-yard line, and they got exactly to the 35-yard line. The others were deeper. I think one was at the 21, and I think one was at maybe the 28. That's lost field position, and I understand you kickoff. You got Brandon Banks back there. You get the ball in his hands, anything can happen. But over the years, we've seen the Ticats take the ball after a field goal at the 35 to get the offense out there. I thought this was a really poor decision. They lost field position. They lost time off the clock. That could have been a factor in them moving the ball down and scoring to win this football game. What do you think? Were you surprised, or did you even notice?
To be honest, I didn't really notice, but I don't have a huge problem with it because, like you said, Brandon Banks is back there, and you never know. But also, I look at it the other way too, and the 35-yard line is pretty good field position to start off with, a pretty good offense So, no, I could go either way on it. I'm not gonna harp on it too much because of the speedy B factor. So I could go either way.
Okay, so the last one that kind of made me a little unhappy, let's say, is the Ticats had put together a pretty decent drive, and they were around midfield, and they picked up 7 yards on first down, and they had a second and three. I'm not sure if you're gonna remember this play, but on the second and three play, where they're moving the football, they 3 yards hit someone across the middle, even run it perhaps. Although we know that they just don't do that. They call a play, and clearly the first read is a deep out route to Andy Fantuz, 20, 25 yards down the field. They throw this, they miss it. It goes incomplete, they punt the ball. I don't understand when they're getting the offense into a rhythm, why you throw a deep ball in that situation. It was very questionable for me as to what. Pick up the first down, and you know what I mean? Like, I just, it again, not a huge thing, but one of those things where, in a situation like this, where they're in a close game and they need the ball more than they need anything else, why are you throwing a deep out route on second down and three? I don't know, second and 12, second and seven, maybe second and three, pick up the 3 yards and give yourself some more life. They punted the ball, and that was the end of the drive. It was just, I didn't like the call. That's all there was to it.
Yeah, I didn't like it either. They 3 yards, just get the damn first down and keep the ball moving. I like when coaches are aggressive, but in that situation, you just gotta move the sticks and keep the offense on the field, keep it rolling. So just get the first down. For God's sake, just don't do a shotgun handoff, but just keep the offense on the field and keep it going. We don't need these huge throws on second and three. It's just not necessary.
Man, shotgun handoff near with short yardage situation. You must have been flipping out when you watched that Ottawa Calgary game and they did the shotgun handoff to Nick Grigsby and they fumbled the ball. And yeah, you must have been.
Right near the end zone.
Yeah.
Oh, Jesus. I can't stand that play. I don't care what this like percentages are. Every time they do it, I just cringe. Or any team, I just hate it. But anyways.
I hate to do this, but it's something we have to talk about, and it's the officiating. I thought there was some, and maybe it's not even the officiating. I think that might be that incorrect. We have to talk about the command center. There were three pass interference penalties in this game that were not called on the field that were overturned by replay. One was on Johnny Sears. One was on, I think it was Quinton Pointer, and then one was on someone from Winnipeg. I was most, we're a Ticats podcast. I wasn't focused that much on who was getting penalties for the Bombers. They all looked really questionable to me. The Sears one, I think, was absolutely ludicrous. I think that was just awesome defense. Yeah, he might have been there a half second early, but that's part of the game of football. And I was all for the review system being overhauled and for there to be more things that coaches could challenge and all that other sorts of stuff. But now I think it's getting a little ridiculous. You could call a penalty on pretty much any play on offense or defense if you look at it and break it down to the nanosecond. And I think we saw in this game with these three pass interference penalties. And I think that the first one on Sears set the tone for the other two. I don't know if the other two were, again, I'm sitting in the stands and I'm seeing it on the replay board, but it's not exactly a great view. Like, it's not as good as if you're sitting at home watching on TV like you were. They all looked really questionable to me, but I think with assessing the Sears one as pass interference, I think that led to the other two being called pass interference. I just didn't like it. I just thought that they were fine defensive plays, especially the Sears one, and I think that's just they're taking something out of the game by focusing on these nanosecond, like, it's just ridiculous, I think.
Yeah, I think that the second pass interference call on Hamilton was influenced from the first one. I mean, if they called that pass interference in the first penalty, they have to call it on the second one because they're very similar. And maybe the second one was a little bit worse. But these are, fractions of a second before the ball gets there. And it just, I don't think you can blame the officials. I think they're going by the rule book. That's what it is. It's you can't touch the receiver past 5 yards or 10 yards or whatever it is. So that's just the way it is. And we're going to be seeing a lot more of it, so we better get used to it because I think they're going to be calling it like that all season long.
That's unfortunate. And the other thing in this was we caught a break on Chad Owens' touchdown late in the third quarter. If you there's a screenshot that someone took, I think it was Derek Taylor of TSN, where you can see two Ticats receivers well offside before the ball is snapped. Now, someone from Winnipeg also went, I think it was Euclid Clemmings, also went offside at the same time. And isn't this the scenario that they told us about where the eye in the sky was going to correct this? Now, I don't know who was offside first. I did not, I'm not a masochist, so I did not go back and watch this game again. But in seeing the pictures, it definitely looks like the Ticats receivers are offside first. And look, we caught a break, and that's great, and we love that and all that sort of stuff. But wasn't this eye in the sky thing that they were trumpeting over the offseason supposed to correct things like this? Like, I don't think this touchdown should have stood. And if you and I you know, I break down the highlight film to get audio for our intro every week, and I was going to use the Chad Owens touchdown as one of the things, but I can't because Rod Black's like, Ticats are offside, this isn't going to count, and they don't really talk about the touchdown at all, and then you have, oh, it is a touchdown. It just seemed like the eye in the sky was this thing that they were saying, hey, if there's multiple, if a guy jumps offside, but another, two guys jump offside, but this will be help us determine who it is. If this isn't what it's there for, then kind of like, what's the point of even having it, you know?
Well, I think that they can't call a penalty. Like, if the penalty's not called, then they can't just look at the replay and be like, oh, there was, oh, maybe not. I don't know how it works, to be honest. But yeah, on that play, you know, Rod Black was saying, because I was watching on TV, obviously, I saw the defensive offside. I didn't see the receivers of the Ticats offside. So I was like, what the hell are you talking about? That was clearly defensive offside. But then they showed the replay and I realized what he was talking about. And they were, Chad Owens was 4 yards, 5 yards offside. So I'm not sure how they missed that. And yeah, the eye in the sky, I guess, should have changed it. I'm not sure the exact rules. It might be if there's a penalty on the field, they can change that and maybe can't call penalties from up above.
Yeah, you could be right. But like, if the point is to correct obvious mistakes, if that's not their mandate, then what's the point of even having it? It's kind of what I'm saying. But maybe you're right. Maybe they can't do it. But if they can't, then why even bother with it? I don't know. Anyway, speaking of Chad Owens, it's now your favorite part, I would think, because I think you enjoy the pain that this causes me of how good he's playing right now, but it's the Chad Owens jersey watch. So, his total so far this season, 17 catches for 228 yards and 2 touchdowns in 3 games. Those are tremendous numbers. Like I said, he's 7th, I believe, or 8th in the league in receiving yards. Like, this guy's having a monster start to the season. Here are his projected totals for the season. 102 catches for 1,368 yards and 12 touchdowns. To put that in perspective, he's currently on pace for career highs in all 3 categories. His career high for a single season in catches was 94, and he did in back-to-back years in 12 and 13. His season high for receiving yards is 1,328 that he did in 2012, and that was his only 1,000-yard receiving season of his career, which is kind of amazing when you think about it. And his most touchdowns in a season, 7 in 2014. So if he stays healthy and continues putting up these numbers, he is going to smash every single personal record he has for one season at 34. Like, yeah. You kind of just got to give it up for him just based on that.
Yeah, must be steroids. No, I'm just joking. yeah, he's playing. We can only hope that when Claris gets in there, they have the same connection that him and Mazzoli have seemed to been building up over the first 3 games. And I think they will, because they played together in Toronto, even though Claris was a backup, but he was in there as a starter when Ray got injured. So I think that if he can stay healthy, he's going to have one hell of a season, a record-breaking season for him.
My God, Mike, you are just the king of segues today. We talk about Chad Owens to get us into a Chad Owens conversation, and you bring up Mr. Zach Collaros himself. Let's go right into the big news of the week for the Ticats that's not game-related. Zach is back. He is on the practice. He's off the 6-game. He's practicing with the team. It's kind of incredible. I've seen some comments of people thinking, oh, it's the 1-2 start that had this, but it seems to be that this was the plan all along. He's on the practice field. Now, he's not taking starters reps. Mazzoli is still taking the starters reps, but he is running scout team. So he's getting some rust off. He will not play or dress against Montreal this Friday, so we can put that to bed. But look, the 1-2 start is horrific. This news kind of builds the spirits back up a little bit, no?
Yeah, absolutely. To have your star quarterback nearing starter's duty is a great thing. I don't think it has anything to do with the 1-2 start. I don't think Austin would jeopardize Claris' health if he wasn't ready to start practicing again. So I don't think that has anything to do with it. I just think that he's getting real close, and we're going to see him in the maybe 2-3 weeks from now. Maybe not the game against Edmonton, maybe a game or two after that. But get ready, because he's almost back.
So with pulling him off the 6-game, that means that his entire salary counts towards the cap, where it didn't when he was on the 6-game. If they would have kept him on there, he would have been out until, I believe it was the BC game on the 10th. But now we have this game coming up against Montreal, which we know he won't play in. I think Edmonton might be as much as fun as you would have that he's there. It would be pretty cool to see him be there for his return game. I think that might be a little too soon, because right after the Edmonton game, they go into that bye week, and then they go into Winnipeg. I think Winnipeg now is the guarantee. I say guaranteed like I know something. That's where I'm betting my money on, is that on August 3rd, that Wednesday night at Investors Group Field, I think that's when we see number four back as a starting quarterback from this team. So I think we got two more weeks of Jeremiah Mazzoli. I think we get the bye week. And then I think Zach is back starting for this club against the Bombers a week earlier than everyone would have anticipated with him being put on the six-game injured list.
That would be great. The earlier the better. Just to have him back in the lineup is a huge boost to the offense and the whole team in general. Just a big morale boost for the Ticats. It's just exciting to think about. I hope he's still the same guy. I think he will be the same guy, and he'll lead this offense to great things.
So a little earlier in the week, after the game against Winnipeg, Ticats made a trade and dealt their third-string quarterback Jake Waters to Saskatchewan for a negotiation-less player, which was later revealed to be quarterback B.J. Daniels. So at the time this happens, I'm thinking, okay, they're trading Waters, and it never even clued into me. It's like, okay, well, Everett Golson is ready to be on the roster, which makes me happy. As a Notre Dame fan, we talked about it when Golson was signed a few weeks ago. I got kind of giddy about it. So it looks like Golson is going to be on the roster definitely this Friday. But I never thought that it meant, because the team only really wants to have four quarterbacks around, that Kolaros would be coming back. But now with Kolaros coming back the day after Waters was traded, it kind of all makes sense, because Daniels is still exhausting NFL opportunities and probably won't ever come to Hamilton, like maybe ever, or he won't be here for quite some time. So this I didn't think of it at the time, but now I feel kind of foolish not realizing that, oh my God, this was to make room for Kolaros to finally practice. But yeah, so Waters was sent to Saskatchewan, and so now we see a little bit of QB shuffling, and I'm happy. I can't wait to see Golson just out there, because I doubt he's going to get a lot of reps, but it's just kind of cool that a guy that I watched in college play for my favorite college team is now playing for my favorite professional football team. It's kind of neat.
Yeah, that would be cool. I never had that experience, really. So yeah, it's kind of a ho hum trade. You know, we didn't really see much of Waters. We don't know what he has. We don't know what he's gonna be. And BK Daniels, we never see him. So kind of a not much to talk about trade, but it is what it is.
Yeah, well, it's what came out of the trade more than what the trade actually netted either team. You know what I mean? Like, it's the big picture that I was trying to get across, that like, now that you've seen everything that's happened, it all kind of sort of melds together and makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we got to talk some CFL news, because why the hell not, right? So we finally, last week we were talking about what happened in that Ottawa game. You named Daron Carter and Rick Campbell your co-bozos of the week. And we kind of got into the conversation about just what the heck happened. The punishments for that game came out, and we saw Daron Carter suspended for one game, and we saw fines leveled against Rick Campbell, Jarrell Gavins, and Jermaine Robinson. Now, I'm fine with the suspension for Carter. I'm fine with the fines for Campbell and Gavins, but I was sickened that Jermaine Robinson was not suspended for his absolutely unnecessary headhunting hit on Daron Carter. Again, we talk about teams and the league trying to make this game safer, and this was a chance for them to put the hammer down and say this is unacceptable, and they failed miserably. It was very clear that he was going after his head. This was not an accident or anything like that. This was a deliberate attempt to injure a player, and I think the CFL got it wrong in not suspending Robinson, period.
Well, yeah, he's the one that launched his head into Carter's head. I mean, if you're preaching player safety all the time, then you have to show it in your actions. So he should have got suspended one game. Now, that's probably all it's going to be. You're not going to get multiple game suspensions unless you do something really crazy in the CFL. So he got fined, and that's, it's not good enough. He should have been suspended as well with Carter. So just not a very good decision by the decision makers in the CFL who make those calls to suspend or fine. It should have been a suspension.
Yeah, and one of your inaugural Bozo of the Week, Arash Madani, came out with an article, I'm sure you saw, that said that Carter should have been suspended for two or three games for his actions. And like that never would have been upheld in a million years. I think the most we've ever seen a player suspended for was Khalif Mitchell for two games, when he tried to rip Simeon Rotier's arm out of his socket when Rotier was with Edmonton and Mitchell was with BC. Do you remember that happening?
That was brutal.
Yeah, absolutely. So that, to me, that was a very deliberate attempt to injure and all that other sort of stuff, and a complete bonehead move. What Carter did was stupid, and I'm totally on board with the suspension, but to give him 2 or 3 games, like, you're out of your mind.
That's not on the same level as what Cleve Mitchell did. I mean, he bumped into Rick Campbell. He didn't push him or anything. It was just kind of a slight bump. It's not taking someone's arm and try to rip it out of the socket. So, yeah, it definitely, I don't think it deserved 2 or 3 games. 1 game's good enough, in my opinion.
Did you see Campbell's comments? Did you watch the Red Blacks Stampeders game?
Yeah, I saw most of it. I didn't see the overtime, but I saw most of it.
Okay, you saw the beginning of the game then?
Yeah.
Okay, did you see when they showed Campbell doing a media scrum and commenting on how, I guess, I don't agree with the fine and all that other sorts of stuff?
Yeah, he said he was looking up at the scoreboard or something like that when he got bumped.
And basically that the league is basically saying that you could be a victim and still be in the wrong. I was absolutely disgusted by those comments. Like, imagine if that was – and why Campbell wasn't fined for commenting on that, I will never understand. Because could you imagine if a player came out and said that? Like, the league fined me, but hey, I was a victim in this, and I don't really understand why they fined me, and it's kind of stupid that they did. Like, a player would have been, like, just taken to the woodshed for comments like that, but we let it go because it's a head coach. Shouldn't we be holding these head coaches to a higher standard?
Yeah, you'd think so. I don't really understand his – he had a part in it as well. He's just angry about the situation, and I don't agree with what he said, so that's about it.
No, I feel like he's starting to gain a bit of a reputation outside of the capital region as a bit of a knob. Like, yeah. He's a good coach, but he's, I don't know, there's something about him that just, I don't like his attitude. I think that's it.
He's a very confused knob. He looks confused all the time.
Speaking of confused, holy smokes, you're doing a great job here. Were the Riders confused about something that Matt Sewell said at the 2013 CFL Combine? Because they went and traded for him. We talked about last week in the Sean Lemon trade. And Sewell decided to retire. And the reason I bring up the Combine is that apparently in 2013, he told all the teams at the draft Combine, I only want to play close to home, so I only want to play for Toronto or Hamilton. And then he was with the Tennessee Titans in the NFL. He got an invite there and turned down an NFL contract to return to play at McMaster because of how much he wanted to play close to home. He's from Milton, so he got drafted by Toronto and he played there and they dealt him, but he decides to retire rather than join the Riders because he only wants to play close to home. And, we've seen Rider fans. They've been dealing with players that get traded to them and then retiring all offseason. It's become a bit of a running joke. But with Matt Sewell, this is just the Riders not doing their homework, no?
I completely agree. You have to know what you're getting into when you make those trades. They gave away a pretty good player for who else did they get in that trade, though?
They got Mitchell Gale, the quarterback.
Yeah, Mitchell Gale. He could be good. He could be terrible. Who knows about him? But, they needed the offensive line depth, and they just didn't look into it. And it's their own fault. I blame them for not doing their homework. And, they shot themselves in the foot. That's about it.
Yeah, so Sewell retires and apparently has made it very clear that he only wants to play, like I said, in Toronto or Hamilton. The Riders' only option to get anything for this guy would be to trade him to Hamilton, because obviously Toronto doesn't think he's any good, or they wouldn't have dealt him. So, yeah. And I can't see Hamilton. They know this guy only wants to play here now. I can't see Hamilton giving up much of anything to get him. It's maybe getting Sewell wasn't a big thing for the Riders, but we talked about last week, like, they needed offensive line depth, Canadian offensive line depth. He would have been a good fit there. He could have done, like, even if he wasn't starting, there's a player that they now don't have. And yeah, it's just Saskatchewan not – I don't blame them for the other retirements when they traded for Bruce Campbell, when they traded for Maurice Price or any of the other guys. Terrius George retired. Like, there was a ton of retirements in Saskatchewan. I can't even remember them off the top of my head. I don't blame them for that. This one, though, is completely – they screwed up on this, period.
Yeah, you got to question his passion for football. I mean, this guy only wants to play in two places. He won't even go to the NFL to play. He just either wants to play in Toronto and Hamilton, and they're not gonna trade him. I mean, what are they gonna get for him? Everybody knows that their feet are to the fire, and they can only trade him to one team. So I don't think he has a lot of passion for football. I don't know him personally. I don't know that for sure, but it just seems that way that he just, a lot of football players would kill to play on any team. And he has a very selective, he chooses very selectively with just Toronto, not even Ottawa. I don't even, Ottawa's in Ontario. I know it's far away from Toronto Hamilton area, but it's just a bad situation for the Riders. And we probably won't see Sewell ever play again in the league.
No, probably not. Okay, Mike, it's time for everyone's favorite new segment, Mike's Bozo of the Week. Who gets this dishonor this week, sir?
Well, I'm going with the Ty Cat player. It hurts to do, but I got to go with Tyquan Underwood. This guy has had his troubles every time he's gotten a game, it seems. I can't remember exact situations, but I remember shaking my head going, oh, he messed up again, you know? And that catch that he should have made could have turned the ball game around. I know that one play doesn't determine the ball game. I know that the Ty Cats had four or five turnovers, and Mazzoli had a big part in it too, but professional wide receiver has to make that catch. It's just that simple. It was a perfect pass. He ran a beautiful route, a stop and go. He blew by the defender. Everything was beautiful, and then he just up the catch. It was just terrible to watch. I couldn't believe it, and he gets the Bozo of the Week this week, not just because of that, but because of past things that have happened when he's gotten on the field. So sorry, Underwood. I hope you bounce back. I hope that, you know, you make me eat my words, but I just had to give it to him this week.
I think that's completely justified, and the drop is especially bad considering the very next play was that weird volleyball tip interception that went into the hands of Mo Leggett and completely killed the drive. Ty Cats lose by 4. Again, there were a lot of plays in this game that I think could have turned the tide. But yeah, I think, unfortunately, that Tyquan Underwood does indeed deserve this week's Bozo of the Week. So let's move on and let's go to the game that is ahead of us on Friday night, Montreal. The Ty Cats head there to play the Montreal Alouettes, a place that they have not had a lot of success the last dozen or so years, but finally got off the schneid last year when Jeff Matthews went in there and led them to a victory. The big thing the thing I will always remember from that game is Luke Tasker making that incredible matrix back catch that just, it's one of those things you need to see to believe, and it's hard to describe, but it was.
Willie Mays type baseball catch, you know, over the shoulder type thing.
Yeah, actually, like it's hard to describe, but yeah, it's a great way of describing it. So they headed to Montreal. The Owls are banged up. Kenny Stafford has been put on the 6-game injured list. SJ Green is out for the year. We don't know what's going to happen with Daron Carter. He's in concussion protocol. He's appealing a suspension. He might play. He might not play. Terrell Sutton has been put on the 6-game injured list. And Kevin Glenn is maybe playing, maybe not playing. We don't know yet. So, Mike, the offense, let's start there. What are you looking for from the offense to get the W in this game and get the Ty Cats back to 500?
Well, pretty simple. Mazzoli can't turn over the ball. I think that he'll produce. I think he'll put up numbers. I think he'll throw touchdown passes. I think all that good stuff will happen. But if he turns over the ball like he did last week, we're in big trouble and we're going to lose this game. So that's my number one thing is Mazzoli, no turnovers. And then the big three, it's just they keep, like you said earlier, Fantuz, Owens, Tasker, they have to keep producing and, you know, help out Mazzoli with those big catches and those big yards and those big plays. So number one thing, though, is limit the turnovers. Maybe, you know, I'll give them one, you know, that's going to happen. But if they have multiple, then we're in big trouble.
I couldn't agree with you more. My defensive keys to the game, it's tough to...
Give Gable the ball more, but it seems like we just say that every week, so that's just a given.
Yeah, like, I went on my Gable rant earlier, so we know how I feel about that. Like I was going to say, defensively here, it's tough kind of to talk about quarterback play because we're not quite sure who's going to start for the Owls in this game. It really looks like it's going to be Rakeem Cato because Kevin Glenn has missed the first 2 days of practice. So you got to hound Kevin Glenn. Like, you know how much I love KG. I've been a fan of his for a very long time, dating back to his Winnipeg days. I've always been a major proponent of Kevin Glenn. I think he's a good quarterback. I think he takes too much crap from people. But we know his limitations better than most. He was here for 3 years and we saw it. If you get in his face, he will make mistakes. Now, if they're going to be playing against Rakeem Cato, and we saw this last year in a game early in the season in Montreal, Glenn we know isn't very mobile. He's not a statue by any stretch of the imagination, but he's not going to run. Whereas Cato, if he gets a crease there, he will take off and run. So if Glenn's in there, you got to get in his face. You got to make sure that he does not have any time to make any plays. But if Cato's in there, you have to be gap sound. You have to make sure that you don't allow him to roll out and make plays on the run, because that is where he is most effective. So a lot is going to depend on who the quarterback is as to what this team needs to do defensively. But so I'm going to give both those, of what they need to do with Glenn and what they need to do with Cato. Another thing they need to do is they need to contain Brandon Rutley. And Rutley's going to be seeing a lot of the rock in this game. Montreal likes to run the football, and he's going to be the guy that takes the rock now that Terrell Sutton is hurt. And he's a darn good running back. He was here in Hamilton for a cup of coffee and played pretty well when he got the chance. He didn't see much game action, but I do remember thinking, this guy has something. And last year, in the game that ended Hamilton's 10-game winning streak here at Tim Hortons Field, Rutley had a massive touchdown for the Alouettes. It was a big, like, 70-something yard catch and run. It was awesome. I really like Brandon Rutley as a player, so they really need to contain him. But probably my number one thing that this team has to do, and this is might be something I say every week, stop committing penalties. This team just has a knack for taking terrible penalties at the absolute worst time, and they have to cut it out. This team right now, as they're currently made up, are not good enough to overcome the numerous mistakes this team makes. We saw it against BC with three consecutive offside calls. We saw it the same thing, similar things at least, against Winnipeg. We cannot have that many penalties, because this team is just not good enough right now to overcome those things. The one thing I will say, though, is that in looking at it, both the number of their penalties and the amount of yards they've given up on penalties has gone down week after week. So in week one, they had 13 penalties for 133 yards. In week two, they had 13 penalties for 105 yards. And last week at Winnipeg, they had 9 penalties for 79 yards. Single-digit penalties I can accept, but again, it's the drive-killing ones on offense. It's the offside ones that make a 2nd and 7, a 2nd and 2. It's stuff like that that they need to get better at. So penalties, stop with the penalties.
Yeah, the penalties are the big thing on defense, and turnovers are the big thing on offense. If we can limit both of those things, we're golden.
So you ready to make some picks?
Yep.
Okay, so I got to say this every week. Join our Pick'em group. We have 25 people in the Pick'em group now. I'd like to see that number get up higher. It's Oski Wee Wee's. I will be putting it, again, as always, as a link in the podcast preview that I put on 3 Down Nation. Find the group, click on it, join, because if you're a Ticats fan or not a Ticats fan, you can win an awesome Ticats prize pack, courtesy of myself. You'll get a large black t-shirt and a toque. So the top 3 after week 3 stand as, Mike, you are still in first place, killing it with 1,057 points. We have Jason, a newcomer, who is in second place with 876 points. And my good friend Richard is in third place with 737 points. I sit in fourth place with 666 points, a.k.a. the devil's points. So I need some wins here and there to get off this number, because it's a little spooky that I'm on 666. So yeah. I got to make some moves. I'm still gunning for that top spot, Mike, even though you're 400 points ahead of me. Holy smokes.
Yeah, that can change pretty quick with the confidence level thing. And so it can change on a dime. I think I don't know what happened with the tie. Like, I don't know if I got any points for that or not.
Yeah, I'm not really sure. I didn't really check. I figured that was just a wash for everybody. It just kind of doesn't count.
More than likely. I think I was 3-1 the first week, 2-2, and maybe
2-1 the second week.
Yeah, so I'm still doing all right. But I think I need to step up my game a bit this week.
Yeah, so I've been so up and down that I was contemplating flipping a coin this week, but I've decided to make my own picks this week. And if I finish at 2-2 or 1-3 or 0-4, next week I'm going coin. We're flipping coin. That's how I'm going to make my picks. So Wednesday night, we have the opener of the week. It's a Wednesday night game. A lot of people complain about Wednesday night games, but this is that Wednesday night where there's no other sports on television. It's the off day between the MLB All-Star game and the restart of the second half of their season. And people for years have been clamoring for the CFL to put a game on Wednesday night. We got one. It's tomorrow night in Toronto. The Ottawa Red Blacks head to BMO Field to take on the Argos. Mike, who you got in this game?
Yeah, I just want to touch on that. I mean, now everyone's complaining about a Wednesday night game.
And, I know, right?
But whatever. It is what it is. People like to complain. But, you know, this is a tough one. Toronto's looked good after that Hamilton game. Ottawa's looked really good, especially in the first half of the last game. Trevor Harris was on fire. I think he cooled off a bit in the second half. They're in Toronto. I'm going to go with the Argos in the upset. I'm going to pick the Argos to win.
We are on the same boat here, my friend. I am also taking the Argos. I saw some cracks in the Ottawa facade against Calgary. They came very close to losing that game. Chris Williams, I think, is still going to do the Chris Williams thing. I think he's the MOP right now, as far as I'm concerned. The things that he's done in the first 3 weeks, phenomenal. And it's great. I love watching great players make great plays. He's been absolutely awesome.
Yeah, he's a CFL player. He's meant for this league. He's just been off the charts in the first three games.
Yeah, but I still like the Argos. They're coming off two big wins on the road. They're coming home to BMO. They want to get a win there to get that ugly taste of the week one thrashing out of their mouths. So in a very, very close contest, I think I'm going to take the Argonauts in this one. Thursday night sees the Edmonton Eskimos head to Winnipeg to take on the suddenly hot Winnipeg Blue Bombers. No, that's not right. They're 1-2. They beat a Ticats team that killed themselves, but still credit to Winnipeg for the win. Who you got in this one, Esks or Bombers?
You got to go with the Eskimos. I think that they've given up a lot of points on defense in the two games, but I think their offense is just so much better than it was last year. I think Riley looks really, really good. So I'm gonna have to go with the Eskimos beating the Bombers on Thursday night.
Yeah, I'm taking the Eskimos in this one as well. I think this could be a shootout, though. Winnipeg's offense looked to finally click a little against Hamilton, and we've seen the Esks give up a lot of points so far this season. One thing we could know for certain is this is probably going to go to overtime, considering the Eskimos have played in two OT games. And I tried to find out if there was any team that had played three consecutive overtime games, and apparently not. No one has said. I haven't heard any confirmation that anyone has. Two seems to be the record, at least in the most recent past. So, hey, overtime football is always welcome as far as I'm concerned, but I don't think this one's going to go to overtime. I think the Eskimos win this one handily in Winnipeg and start to get the ball rolling going through the rest of the season. Friday night, the game we just previewed, we see the Hamilton Tiger Cats head to Montreal to take on the Alouettes. Mike, who you got in this one?
Yeah, that's another tough one. We talked about it, but I'll go with the Ticats. I think the Mazzoli will have a somewhat bounce back game. I think he'll have good numbers, and I think the turnovers will be lower than they were last week. So, and Montreal's really beat up, so I'm going to have to go with the Ticats.
This is extremely difficult because my heart is leaning one way and my head is kind of leaning another. But then there's a part of me that, like you said, Montreal is banged up. The starting quarterback could be down. Their starting running back is out. Two receivers are gone. It could be three. As much as I'm down on the Ticats right now, I think if Montreal was fully healthy, I would have gone against Hamilton in this one. But I'm going to pick Hamilton. I have next to no confidence in this pick. I'm still going to go 100% confidence on my pick on Pick'em because that's just what I do. But yeah, this one to me it's really close to call. But give me the Ticats by the slimmest of... This could be like a 1 or 2 point victory for Hamilton. So I'll take the Ticats. The week wraps up on Saturday night with the BC Lions heading to Regina to take on the Saskatchewan Rough Riders. Who you got in this one?
Oh, that's another tough one. Jennings didn't look good in his last outing. Lule looked pretty good. But the Riders looked pretty good in Edmonton. So, you know, Durant seems to be back to his old ways. I'm going to go for the upset. I'm going to pick the Riders.
So you picked Toronto. You picked Edmonton. You picked Hamilton. You picked Saskatchewan. I picked Toronto. I picked Edmonton, I picked Hamilton, and I picked Saskatchewan. I like the Riders in this one, too. They have been so close in their first two games, a lot less close against Toronto, don't get me wrong, but they have played really well. They look way better than they did last year, and it's a couple plays here and there. I think the home crowd gives them the advantage here, and I like the Saskatchewan Rough Riders pick up their first win of the season. This team is vastly improved from a season ago, I still like BC. I still think they're a good team, but they showed a lot of flaws against Toronto. They were at home, and they kind of got the brakes beaten off them. It was a lot closer than it really should have been, but yeah, I like the Riders in this one, too.
I just have to go with them this week.
Yeah, so we are all on the same teams this week, so if I do really poorly, you'll do really poorly, If I do well, you'll do well, so my chances of catching you this week are not going to be great, unless the confidence and tiebreaker points somehow break in my advantage, but we'll have to wait and see. So I guess I can say with some certainty that I won't be first place next week, but we'll have to wait and see. I'm coming for you. I guess some weeks I'm going to have to pick against you just to make up some ground, but this week is not one of them.
No, we won't be picking the same picks every week, so we'll see what happens.
Okay, question time, Mike. Now, I got one that is less of an opinion question where we can go back and forth, but more of a factual question. So Mark, a constant guy who gives us questions, asked on the Three Down Nation comment section, this is about Brett Maher. He said, I read this morning that Brett Maher was fined for the ridiculous low hit against BC. That was the hit where he was flagged for a chop block, I believe it was. He went low and blocked the BC player, and he was fined for it, apparently. Now Mark thinks that all Maher was trying to do was get out of the way and of a larger player and avoid injury, which I think is fair. But he asked, when was the last time that a punter or kicker was fined for a quote-unquote dangerous hit? Now, I didn't know the answer to this, so I reached out to someone that I thought would. Three Down Nation's resident stat man, Mr. Mark Fulton, for everyone out there in the Twitterverse, that's FenderGuy69, asked him if he had an answer, and he did. But before I give that answer, I'm curious, do you think you know who the answer to this question is?
Well, I just have to go with my educated guess and say Noel Prefontaine, but just because over his career he laid out quite a few hits in the return game, so I'd have to say him.
That is not a bad guess, but would you believe it that it was Brett Maher?
Really?
When he was in Ottawa in 2014 in a game against Saskatchewan, he was flagged for a similar type of hit and was fined for it. Kind of crazy that it's the same guy.
Yeah, that's didn't see that coming.
No, pretty surprising. Like, clearly this guy's a menace, Mike. Like, he must be removed from the league. He's low-hitting guys every other year. Like, we got to get rid of him. He shouldn't be playing. Yeah,
put him in at linebacker.
So, yeah, that was the one question I got. And when I found out the answer, I was like, that's pretty surprising. He's got a history of this. This guy, he can't be kicking. Yeah, like you said, put him in at linebacker. Do you have any questions this week?
Yeah, I got a couple here. One from Adam Stalker, Astalk3 on Twitter. What have you guys thought of Stefan Potasik's play calling?
I'm unsure as how this play calling thing has worked so far. We discussed some pretty weird coaching decisions earlier, and I think two of them, I guess, would have been offensive plays. The bomb on second and three and the not going for two after they scored what would have been if they would have got to two, would have been the tying touchdown. So now the going for two is absolutely a Ken Austin call, but the deep pass was probably a play call that Potasik put in there. I don't think he's been terrible at the job. Obviously it's going to be a learning curve. He's a CIS head coach. Now he's trying to come in and be a play caller at the pro level, but I'm still not sure entirely how much he calls the plays versus how much Austin calls the plays. But again, I wasn't expecting him to come out of the gates and be Tommy Condell when he first started. So again, it's a wait and see approach, but I think he's been all right. I don't think the offense, I don't think the play calling has been an issue much with the Ticats, with the exception of the ones we outlined before and the fact that they don't give CG Gable the football. But can we really blame Potasik for not giving Gable the football? They haven't given the running backs the football and been pretty much Austin's entire time here.
Yeah, I just don't know if he's calling the plays right now. I don't know if Austin's calling all the plays. I don't know how much influence he has in the offensive scheme. I'm sure he has some. I mean, he's the quote-unquote offense coordinator, but I thought they were kind of grooming him until a later date when he was more prepared to actually call the plays. So I can't really comment on that because I'm not sure how many plays he's actually calling. All right, so give me a second here. We got one from Rob Scott, 99AA Tigers coach on Twitter. What's your take on Courtney Steven at safety through three regular season games?
I don't really have much thought on him. I haven't really paid that much attention to what he's been doing out there. I don't think he's been to blame for any of the, like, any poor play back there. He's a natural safety. He was moved to the wide side corner position when they signed Craig Butler, but Steven did come into this league as a safety, and the thought was that he would be the team safety. I kind of will defer an answer to you here because I kind of haven't really been paying that much attention. I guess that means that he hasn't been doing a poor job. If he was doing a poor job, I'd be more inclined to call him out. So I guess he's done all right.
Yeah, it's hard to tell when you're back there at safety. You're not involved as much as you would be if you're at the wide side corner spot like he was last year. But yeah, I'd have to agree with you. I'm not sure. I don't think he's been in any broken coverage where he made a mistake and they got deep over top of him or anything like that. So I think he's probably doing a great job back there. I think he's a great defender, and we're just going to have to trust that he's doing a good job because I can't really tell, to be honest.
Yeah, like I said, it's one of those things where if I thought he was doing a poor job, it probably would have been brought to my attention at some point, either through the play's play on the field or through reading stuff about other people following the game. You know, Steve Milton, Drew Edwards, guys like that, who I get a lot of my Ticats info from. Since no one's really mentioning it, I guess he's at worst, he's been average, which considering how makeshift the secondary is at the time, guys coming in and out, isn't entirely a bad thing.
Yeah, for sure. And then the last question comes from Chris, Gold Bowtie for Life on Twitter.
That is a great Twitter handle.
Yeah,
I don't know what it means, but that is awesome.
Yes, at what point do we stop viewing the Red Blacks and their fans as cute and new?
Oh, boys, you're trying to get me in trouble here, aren't you?
Yeah, I know what's going on.
I have made no bones about the fact that I have my love affair with Ottawa Red Blacks fans has ended, and ended rather abruptly. I have noticed a very I'm going to try to parse my words here so I don't piss too many people off, but I've noticed that they have become very Rider-like, and I don't mean that in all Rider fans. There are some great Rider fans out there, and I think the bad ones really outweigh the good ones, but I have seen very much a closed-minded attitude from some of the more vocal members of our nation, and I do say that derisively. But there, don't get me wrong, there's still some great Red Blacks fans out there and some that I enjoy. I met a bunch when I went out there for the game last year. We went out after the game and it was an awesome time. When I go back out there in October, same thing's going to happen. We're going to watch a game. We're going to enjoy ourselves. We're going to go after, have a few beers, have a bite to eat, and just have fun. They're great people. But the ones that you kind of just interact with online, the ones who kind of hide behind pseudonyms and stuff like that are not exactly the type of fans that I really enjoy. They're very close-minded. They're very much of the idea that if Ottawa says so, then so it is. And it kind of started with me with the whole compensation thing, and it's kind of come to a head where it seems like every time there's a poll of who's the best, these Ottawa fans do what the Riders do, and they come out and they just, oh, it's obviously the guy in Saskatchewan. I saw someone today talk about how it's ridiculous that Justin Dunk's piece on quarterbacks didn't have Trevor Harris at number one. Okay, sure, fine. Like, Trevor Harris has been awesome this year, but Mike Riley had a wicked game against Saskatchewan in week three. Darian Durant has looked great in his first two games and looked awesome against the Eskimos. Like, it's not always just about one team, and it's not always just about your guy. And I know this is just me kind of ranting about certain Red Blacks fans, but it's one of those things where they're really starting to rider it up. They're starting to equal and be like the worst that we see out of Rider fans, and that's not a good look. That really, really isn't a good look. But how do you feel about some of the Red Blacks fans that you've interacted with?
Well, I haven't had that much interaction with it, and no one's really bothered me that much. When Ottawa came into the league, I was overjoyed. I'd give them the first year, but after that, I mean, they're a team, and they're an opponent, they're a rival of the Ticats. So after the first year, it was not cute or fun anymore. So it's just now, it's just what it is. It's like an Argos team or an Alouettes fan or an Argos fan. It's just they're a rival. So I don't think they're cute or new anymore.
Yeah, and I think if they were still terrible, I don't think that we would have such visceral reactions to them. No. I think the fact that they're good, and good for them for being good. The league set it up so that they would be good, and they took advantage of it, and that's credit to them. I'd rather have there be a bunch of teams that are good and that make these rivalries matter than have one team that's basically a free square on the bingo card. But I start to wonder if you know they're a little loud and obnoxious now, that maybe some losses will dampen them a little bit, and we'll see a little bit more humbling. Like, look, we cheer for the Ticats, and we haven't won a championship in over 15 years, and we dealt with, as we say, We dealt with all that crap in the mid-2000s, and Bomber fans are going through basically what we went through then. Bomber fans are going through now, and Ottawa's going to hit a rough patch at some point. That they had a lot of success really early on, and at some point they're going to hit the wood. You know, it's going to happen. They're going to go through a losing streak. It might not be this year, it might not be next year, but at some point they're going to be the team that everyone goes, they're the easy win. Look, Montreal was good for 20 years before they finally came back down to earth. I think that's when we'll probably see these guys be a little more humble. But you know, part of me thinks, their team's good, they kind of deserve to brag, but there's some stuff I see out of them that kind of gets on my nerves. So yeah, the cuteness and all the newness and all that stuff, no, you're in your third year now, you're playing with the big boys, and it's time to act.
Yeah, it's over. The honeymoon's over.
The honeymoon is definitely over.
So that's it for the questions that I got.
All right, so the honeymoon's over, and that means this show is over. Man, you were great with the segues this week, just like providing me an ample opportunity to just move on from thing to thing. Better keep that up. I'm going to be expecting it every week, Mike.
Yeah, I'm the segue king.
All right, so again, don't forget that you can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or listen to it or download it at 3downnation.com. If you want questions, you can hit me or Mike up on Twitter. Mike, your Twitter handle, buddy.
Mike_Ticats.
And I am at @JoshSmith_82. And, you know, you can always throw them in the comment section on 3downnation when the podcast goes up. So this was Podski Wee Wee for this week. I'm Josh Smith.
I'm Mike Graham. Eat 'em raw.
Eat 'em raw.